On the Future Car Podcast, we touch on many aspects of our future mobility, such as autonomous and electric cars, as well as other modes of transportation, air taxis, electric boats. But today, we're going to take a look at yet another form of our future mobility, traveling to space. In recent years, space travel has changed from something that only a few could experience to becoming more accessible, with many commercial companies jumping into the space travel business. And with us today is the founder and CEO of one of those companies, Jane Poynter of Space Perspective, where they've developed the world's first carbon neutral way to travel to the edge of space propelled by a balloon, with a goal to change people's view and perception of Earth. Jane, welcome to the Future Car Podcast.
Hello, hello. How fun to be here.
Well, listen, I want to start right away and ask you about the Explorers Club, which you are a member of. And that is a group of members that are responsible for the famous firsts of humankind. The first to the top of Mount Everest, the first to the North and South Pole, the first to the moon's surface. So tell me, what is the key thing that Space Perspective hopes to be the first of?
Ooh, love it. What we're really about is completely changing the paradigm of space. I mean, you said it right at the beginning, right? That really to date, space has really been for the few. And we are wanting to completely change that so that we can have thousands of people going to space. Remember, to date, only 650 people have ever been to space. Fewer than that number. I mean, that's a minuscule number of people. And we're wanting to be the first to take thousands and thousands of people to space every year.
One of the things when I first heard about you, it says completely carbon neutral way to get to space. And you think, oh, how could that be possible? I see these rockets going up into space, all this smoke and everything going on. Sustainability is a big part of what you're trying to do. How was that an inspiration, and how did it play a key part in what you're doing at Space Perspective?
It's actually core to the business, and it actually goes all the way back to my days in Biosphere 2. So Tabor McCallum and I, my co-founder and I, were involved in a project back in the early 90s. Actually, we were on the design team in the 80s and then lived in it in the early 90s for 2 years and 20 minutes, though who's counting? And just to remind us all what Biosphere 2 was, it at the time was sealed tighter than the International Space Station. It was the very first time that we, humanity, attempted to build the world's first human-made biosphere. It was called Biosphere 2 because, you know, the idea being that planet Earth, our biosphere on the planet, is Biosphere 1. And so we lived inside there, and all of our oxygen was coming from the plants around us. We knew moment to moment that our CO2 was going out to grow our food. You know, we could see the edges of our world with that glass and steel structure around us. And it was really interesting, right? So I went into the biosphere thinking that this was the closest thing that I'm ever get to going to Mars. I went there because I thought it was about going to space. And when I went in, I realized it was also about discovering our planetary biosphere that we all inhabit together. And it turns out that that is a very akin experience to that which astronauts have when they see Earth from space. And what it does is when the astronauts see Earth in space, right, they see that thin blue line of our atmosphere. They see the Earth against the blackness of space. And they get this visceral understanding that we live together as a human family on planet Earth. So this experience actually creates a response that makes one actively, proactively want to solve the grand challenges of today. So it is absolutely at the core of what we're doing at Space Perspective, wanting to take thousands of people up to have that experience and, you know, do something amazing with that experience.
This effect that you talk about, and astronauts have it, your passengers on your spacecraft are going to have it. It's called the overview effect. So you're up there, and now suddenly it's not like you're from a particular country or anything anymore. You're from Earth. And I think maybe what you're saying is Biosphere 1 is the Earth. Biosphere 2 was, well, wait a minute, this is sort of like our mini world here. So you've experienced this firsthand. Tell us about this overview effect. So what is it like? You're up there and suddenly you forget about the country that you're from. Why is that?
Yeah, so I can't speak personally yet from seeing Earth from space. Next year, maybe. That's what I'm aiming for.
Are you going up on the first one?
Certainly on one of the first. You gotta believe it, Ed. Oh, yeah. Well, for one thing, I have to know that this experience that we're offering people is as good as we say it's gonna be, right? So I'll fall on the sword. I will test it myself. So when you talk to astronauts about their experience of seeing Earth in space, they really do talk about it as this visceral experience. For example, when I've spoken to a bunch of astronauts about this experience, and there's sort of different components. Definitely it's seeing that thin blue line, right? When we're down here on the ground, we look up through the atmosphere, that incredible blue sky. It looks like it goes on forever. No. It's 20 miles thick. That's it. Spaceship Neptune is floating on top of the atmosphere. I mean, it's kind of wild to think about that. So when you're in space, you see this tenuously thin blue line. You also don't see boundaries. You don't see any of those borders, the national borders, and those just disappear. And it becomes supremely evident that we are all on this planet together, hurtling through space. And what tends to happen is when astronauts come back from space, they get more involved in social and environmental causes than before they left. So it really does have a very tangible effect on people. And one of the things that it's been really fun chatting with different astronauts who've been to space, and you know, they all have different stories about their experiences. And certainly some of the common threads are seeing something you recognize from space. One person told me about seeing the farm they grew up on, or for us, we're going to be taking people up over the peninsula of Florida, which is going to be supremely recognizable to all Americans, right? And because you recognize it and you kind of know how big that thing is you're looking at, it suddenly becomes apparent how big Earth is. And the ubiquitous comment is, Earth is not that big. It's fascinating. So it's going to be really exciting for us to take people to have that experience. And I can't wait to hear all their stories about what it's like for them personally to see Earth from that vantage point.
Like you said, Earth is not that big. And in fact, it seems like it shrinks Earth down so that you can actually call Earth home. My home is not the United States or Europe or China. It's that blue thing.
I mean, I think it's both, right? I don't think you ever stop being American or Australian or whatever country you come from and you call home. But it certainly expands it now to include all of the planet and really understanding how interconnected the planet is. That's one of the key takeaways.
You gave a talk, it was a TED talk, about your time in Biosphere. And I think to tie it back to that a little bit, one of the things you mentioned in that talk is when we breathe, we could be breathing carbon from a dinosaur or Julius Caesar or who knows, or our great-great-great-great-grandchildren. And in effect, right, I think what you're saying here is when you see the planet without the borders, we're sharing carbon from everything that's lived on Earth that, you know, exudes carbon, right? But you're also now sharing this commonplace that we all have. And you start to think of it more as one or something that's shared by all of us.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I think what becomes supremely apparent is really the only border that counts is the border of that thin blue line of our atmosphere against the vacuum of space. That suddenly becomes supremely apparent, that black vacuum is not hospitable to life, right? But here on planet Earth, it is our oasis. And that is what becomes so apparent.
So what if we could take the right group of people, political leaders from Earth, and bring them up into your spaceship Neptune, as it's called? Do you think that could be a way we could solve some of Earth's problems?
So I love that question because, Yes, I do. And I think that, you know, for us, at Space Perspective, we want to take people of all sorts to space, right? So we want to take artists, scientists, leaders, everyone, because, you know, they're all going to go to space and have their own experience and come back and communicate it in ways that hasn't been communicated differently. You know, I think decisions around climate change would be so much easier if we all really viscerally at our core understand that we are part of a biosphere and we are completely reliant on it, as frankly, it is on us at this point, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's the collective us, right? All of us. Well, let's imagine that you could put together the right set of people to take up there. So I guess two-part question. Who would you bring up to solve the world's problems? But more importantly, there's going to be that moment, right? And I bet you could probably look at people's faces and say, oh, they're having it. They're having the overview effect. What would you say to them? Like, what question would you pose to them at that moment to get them talking about the right things?
Yeah, I think this is a super, super interesting question. I don't know that I have the answer for you, Ed. You know, one of the things we talk a lot about with Spaceship Neptune, right, doesn't really require training. It's a very gentle experience. It's a very accessible experience, right? I mean, if you can get on a commercial airline, you can get on Spaceship Neptune. That's what this space balloon affords us. But now that means we can take anyone to space, but they need to be prepared for it.
Prepared mentally?
Yes, exactly. Prepared mentally. Like, I've talked with people who have been on the Blue Origin flights, right? And they're like, oh, I have to really prepare because I've only got like a couple of minutes in space and I literally have to practice what I'm going to do. I'm like, okay, we don't have to do any of that. But what we should do is go with some amount of intentionality, right? What do I want to experience? And it's really interesting. So we've got sort of our customers fall into two general camps. One is, I'm going there to really bond with Earth. This is going to be a very meditative experience. I'm sharing it with my family. I'm sharing it with my loved ones. We're going all together. Then on the other end of the spectrum, we've got the, yeah, I'm going to celebrate. Woohoo! Party in space. So, you know, great. Both are awesome.
Are they going to both be together? It seems like that'd be like two different crowds,
oh,
right?
No. We got to keep that. That's like having a cocktail party or a dinner where you've invited all the wrong people. Oh, no. Thankfully, 50% of our tickets have been purchased as full flights. So that becomes a little easier. People have self-organized. We still do need to help the rest to make sure that the right people go together, for sure. That's part of curating the experience. But I think making sure people really are prepared for this profound experience that so many have talked about of seeing Earth in space is really paramount.
So this preparation. So now you have these world leaders. You don't have to name the world leaders, but if you could say one thing to them, I would like to prepare you, because once we get up there, I want you to think about this or talk about this. I guess what I'm really looking for is you're going to have this great moment where this overview effect takes effect. Now that's your chance, right? What should we really be talking about?
This may sound like I'm ducking the question a little bit, but I don't think so, because as a business, I don't think it's our job to tell people what to think. What I do think is our job is to give them the experience that allows them to open up to this extraordinary transformation that astronauts talk about.
There you go. So getting the experience is probably enough. If they can't take it from there, that's their problem. You've done everything.
Yeah, look, here's what I will say. What we are conscious of is that a lot of people, when they've had profound experiences, they have all this energy that they want to do something with, and they don't necessarily know what to do with it. So we are beginning to develop partnerships with different groups so that we have, you know, we have some curated list of things that people can get involved with if they want afterwards, right? But certainly don't have to. I mean, a lot of people have the things that they're already doing, and we're hoping that they're just going to go for it even more.
There you go. And I think you gave that example, right? When astronauts come back to Earth and they tend to want to work on these causes more. Let's describe to our listeners, describe the spaceship, describe what's it going to be like. I get in and then what happens?
Yeah. So imagine It's early morning. It's dark out. You step out onto the deck of this beautiful marine spaceport, and you get into this incredibly comfortable space lounge that's inside the capsule of Spaceship Neptune, right? There's a bar there, there's a loo there, there's Wi-Fi, there's these super comfy chairs. You get to sit down. You will be asked to strap in for the first 15 minutes. The pilot will tell you you're about to lift off, and you will feel the spaceship being taken up to space by the space balloon incredibly gently. It's going to be very smooth. So you're rising up, and for about 2 hours, you will be going up to space. Now imagine you're seeing the sun come up over the limb of the Earth. And I've seen video of a sunrise from that altitude. I mean, it's madness. It is astonishingly beautiful. And it starts before sunrise. So you're going to, but first you'll, of course, see the incredible starscape without the sun. So you'll have no light pollution. It'll just be amazing. And then you will start to see the sun, and you see kind of, if you're seeing a sunrise, you'll see sort of these crazy rainbows that come across the planet. And then you'll see the sun against the deep, dark blackness of space. And when you talk to people who have seen this, they talk about the colors being like something they've never seen before. Like the black is the deepest black you've ever seen, which is kind of crazy, actually. And so you'll see that. You'll be up there for a couple of hours, and then it'll take you another 2 hours to come back down. The capsule splashes gently in the water. Two fast boats come over, wave to everybody inside. The ship comes up, picks the capsule, puts it on the deck of the ship. And within about 15 minutes or so of splash, you'll be on the deck of the ship and being brought ashore again and having a great celebration of everything you just experienced.
And what's the size of the capsule, the size of the balloon?
Yeah, so it seats eight customers, explorers, as we call our customers, eight explorers and a captain. Mind you, the captain does not have a whole lot to do. So the vehicle can fly itself. It can be flown from mission control on the ground. And then there's another mission control on the ship. So really, the captain is there just to make sure everybody is, you know, super comfortable and got everything they need in curating this experience. So it is 16 feet in diameter. And so it's roomy. You can get up and walk around and go stand at the bar. You can cheers in the middle. You know, I mean, this thing is also...
No seatbelts required for liftoff and...
Not during the majority of the flight, exactly. I mean, that's the beauty of this thing. It's so incredible smooth. Yes, that's exactly right. And by the way, you're looking out the largest windows ever flown to space. One of my parameters was that one of our board members is like well over 6 feet tall. And I promised him he was going to be able to stand in the window without ducking. I think we've made it.
So the first thing that comes to mind when I hear this is, you see these images of the astronauts when they're going up into space, and they're in their spacesuits. They're in there. They're shaking and rattling, and the rockets. This sounds like you're just floating up, like you'd be in a hot air balloon, pretty much. Is that probably the feeling?
You're right. This is exactly the opposite of how we normally think of a space flight. That's the unlock here. That's what's really making this so accessible. You know, and then we're also adding on our own sort of reimagined way of experience based on top of that. So the capsule itself, you don't have high Gs. You don't need to be wearing a fancy spacesuit or do all the training or any of that. This is absolutely gentle. You're in a pressurized capsule with your beverage of choice and your loved ones, and you're heading to space. I mean, it is just completely different experience. And then the way we designed the interior actually took a huge amount of work. You know, we originally thought, oh, we're taking everybody to space to see the Earth from space. So we're going to sit everybody in front of their own window and stare out at the world. And then all of a sudden, when we set that up in a mock-up, you know, I wanted to talk to people and I was looking over my shoulder. I'm like, uh-oh, we just made this a completely solitary experience. So we flipped it around and now we've got this very social space lounge, as we call it, because we also want it to be incredibly inviting and relaxing for people. And so there's a space lounge for people to look out at Earth. So it's as much a shared, relaxed experience as it is understanding our place in the universe as we look out at our beautiful planet from that vantage point.
This whole idea of sharing, it seems like it's through the whole thing. That's like a big theme. And I like the term explorer. And I have to admit, I first learned about you at CES. You were in the Siemens booth. And I said, oh my God, this is really interesting. And one of your explorers was there. And I started to talk to him. And that's when he said he was an explorer. And he started to describe your lounge. And I'm thinking, what kind of an explorer is that? Explorer, luxury, a lounge. It seems like that usually doesn't go hand in hand. I don't see why it shouldn't, but it's something new.
So for us, it's about discovery. People are going to space to discover something new. And in this instance, it's a completely different perspective. It's the space perspective, right? That's why we call it the company Space Perspective. That ultimately is what we're offering people. And it is. We want people to go into this with that stance of exploration, discovery.
I certainly can see right away for, let's just say, the average person that wants to experience Earth in a new way. Space travel and space station, pretty much every time we've gone up into space, has been tended towards being scientists that want to run experiments. And you've created experiments that have gone up into the space station, all that. How do you see this as a new opportunity for scientists?
We absolutely are taking science payloads on every flight, actually. So we already took science payloads on our early test flights. So one of the huge advantages of what we're doing for science is repeat flights to an area that people have hardly ever gone and studied. It's a very difficult place to get to. Technically, it's called the stratosphere. And it is really important for understanding aspects of climate change, for example, upper atmospheric science. I mean, there's additional science we can do also that is fairly traditionally done with these kinds of balloons, which is with heliophysics and astronomy and astrophysics, because you can fly these huge telescopes. But for us, what's really, really valuable for scientists is that they don't generally get to do multiple flights, one or two, maybe three if they're super lucky. What we're going to be able to offer is repeat flights because we're going to be flying so much. And what's exciting, we're actually already in discussions with a number of really, really valuable organizations whose names you would recognize to fly payloads as part of Spaceship Neptune that fly on every flight because it then gets what's called a transect. We're doing a transect up through the atmosphere and back down. So you're constantly taking data about the atmosphere, different parts of the atmosphere, different atmospheric species, different, you know, obviously temperature, humidity, and all of those kinds of things, but other gases as well that have not yet to date been studied at the degree that we are. And also in the locations, remember, we're going to be out over the ocean, which is difficult to get to as well, all around the world eventually. So we're super excited about what we can do. And let's also talk about kids. So I'm super excited that we actually get to take kids' experiments. So on our first flight, it was precious. We ran a competition and we had kids compete to fly their science payloads. And the two winners happened to be both girls. And watching the videos of them hearing that they had won, it was priceless. I mean, they were screaming. They were so excited about it. So we also get to take kids along on this journey as well, which is so important. And we also flew kids art. You know, we're big proponents of STEAM, not just STEM, but STEAM. And so
engineering and art together.
Yeah, absolutely.
The whole idea of perspective, if there's any group of people on Earth that have a different perspective, it's young kids. Well, going up into space and seeing the thin blue line is something everybody does. I've been doing it all my life. How do you think their perspective would be different?
Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine? Sadly, initially, we're not going to be able to take small kids.
Test it out first. Make sure it works.
Yeah, no, I think so. The FAA allows us to take people 18 and older. What we can do is involve them, though. I don't know about you, but I remember at that age, I was like really wanting to explore the world. So I think it's just going to be completely mind-blowing for some of these kids. I mean, I'm really hoping it is, because what a precious experience for them.
Now, I want to go back a little bit. You're talking about a unique capability of people being able to go over and over again, which makes sense, right? You go up the first time and then you land and you say, oh, if only I would have tried this or would have tried that. And you have some time to think about it. But there are balloons now without people in them that go up to these heights and come back down. The fact that you have someone, you have people in the capsule that's attached to a balloon like that, how does that provide an advantage? Or what can you do with that that you cannot do with just a balloon going to the same altitudes and taking measurements, say, with instruments?
So there's several things there. So one is that actually not very many balloons are flown, space balloons are flown every year. So a scientist is able to send an instrument up on a space balloon currently, but, you know, maybe another couple of years or 5 years before they get to do it again. Whereas what we're offering them, even without flying with their instrument, is to integrate the instrument into the vehicle so the vehicle is flying repeatedly, which is just getting much more data. That's what's needed, not just a one-off data set, but multiple data sets. So that already is hugely important. I think it would be super exciting to think about actually having a laboratory in space. I think that's super exciting. What's interesting as we think about spaceflight, normally we think about having to spend a lot of time, of money, and effort in automating our instruments. And so now if you can send a human with their instrument, you don't have to automate. You can really actually make decisions on the fly whilst you're up there. You know, the human becomes part of actually enacting that research program in space. I mean, look, there's a lot of research that doesn't require a person to be involved, but definitely there is. And I think that's a super exciting opportunity for researchers around the world, actually.
There's other companies, Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, all taking slightly different approaches in terms of how high they go. Blue Origin, somewhat conventional. You're strapped to a rocket ship. It lasts a few minutes. You're on the other end of the spectrum, 6-hour flight, right? Relax. Virgin Galactic, I think somewhere in between. I don't know. It's a little bit less time, but it's not the full rocket feeling. And then there's cost, too. Although not everyone has announced their prices, you have. I think it's $125K. Could you talk a little bit about how you compare to these other approaches, pluses, minuses? Maybe they complement each other. What are your thoughts on these different approaches people are taking to open up space travel to the masses, say?
So I think maybe the first thing to say is that demand for this is huge. What is actually limiting the number of people that are going to space is by no means demand. It is how many operators there are. So because there's so few operators, this is going to be supply side limited for many years to come, which is actually a great place for us as a business to be in. So the way we think about it is that rising tide floats all boats. We are not in competition with Blue Origin and Virgin, and certainly not Axiom or SpaceX, right? It's very different experiences. In many ways, we think of ourselves as a gateway for them. So for example, think about people going up on a rocket flight and, you know, you've literally got 5 or 6 Gs as you're launching or as you're descending. What that feels like, apparently, is an elephant sitting on your chest. Not that I've ever had an elephant sitting on my chest.
It's a good thing to avoid, I heard.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is significant. Let's put it that way. Not for everyone. And, you know, I had one person tell me that they've actually gone to one of these centrifuges to train with these high Gs several times so that by the time they get to their flight, they're truly prepared for it. So for the right person, that's an incredible experience, right? I mean, it's the right stuff. It's I'm going up in a rocket, man. Okay, what we wanted to do was eliminate all of those, well, for many people are barriers, right? When I talk to people about what we're doing, they often say, look, I don't think I could actually go up in a rocket. It's a bit scary. I could definitely do your thing. Because it's the opposite, as we were talking about earlier, right? So just to kind of break it down specifically, so Blue Origin is roughly just over 10 minutes of a flight. Go up with a rocket, there's a parabola at the top, you have a couple of minutes at the top to, you know, float around, look out the window, and then you're coming back down again. It's not a published ticket price. I understand it's somewhere between $1 and $2 million per person. Then Virgin Galactic So their published price is $450,000. You know, that's the space plane. You drop off the bottom of White Knight. The spaceship fires its rockets, and now you're zooming up to space. So again, it is that rocket flight experience where you've got high G's on both ends, and then you've got, you know, a few minutes at the top to look out the window, float around in the cabin. What we are doing is completely focusing on the experience of seeing Earth in space. For many people, that zero G portion is actually disconcerting. And so we have eliminated that as well. So it's a full 1G. You can walk around with your glass of champagne or your cup of coffee or whatever your beverage of choice is.
The champagne stays in the glass.
You do not need a sippy cup.
Okay.
Exactly. The champagne stays in the glass. And so we just sort of eliminated all that because we wanted to really lower the barrier to entry for people so that just really accessible to a lot of people. It's just a very different experience. And we actually are partnered with some of those other companies I talked about. You know, what they're finding is that, you know, somebody wants to go on their flight and then they want to take their family on something like our flight. Just very different. Now, let's just talk about the altitude. You did mention the altitude.
Yes, exactly. You took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to ask you, what is space exactly?
Oh, Ed. There is actually no real definition. There's no ubiquitous definition of space. Let's say that. So from an experience point of view, whether you're going to 300,000 feet or 100,000 feet, which is where we are, you really are not going to see anything different. You'd have to have a straight edge to be able to tell the difference in the curvature. All of them, Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, us, we all are what's called a suborbital flight. You essentially have the same view out the window. And the way to think about what is space, so if you think that we are floating above 99 point something percent of the atmosphere, depending on what time of year it is, the rest, that last 1%, goes out well beyond the International Space Station. We call ourselves going to the edge of space. So we're also in space.
Well, there's this thing called the Kármán line, right?
Yes, that's
right. It seems a little arbitrary.
Yeah,
is it,
a little bit.
Yeah, it.
There is a technical definition about what it is and why it's there, but it's where people get their, I mean, the confusion is that a professional astronaut gets their wings when they've been over the Kármán line.
Okay. But it's not really officially, I guess we've never really come to an agreement on to.
No, there really is not a universally agreed upon definition of space.
Interesting.
Look, we're regulated by the FAA's Office of Commercial Space Transportation.
Ah, and now this is separate from NASA, I would imagine.
Yeah, so it's part of FAA. So we're all regulated by the FAA.
How old is that organization? How long has that been around?
Oh, that's a good question. It's been around a while, at least 10 years, more than that, 15 years. I don't actually know the answer to that, Ed. Oh, now I'm going to have to get on my phone and look. But it's been around a while.
Well, that's actually a good thing, I would imagine, because it seems that sometimes those organizations that, for instance, with electric and autonomous cars, it seems like the electric and autonomous cars were already running around, especially on the autonomous side, before the government said, oh, we better start coming up with some regulations here, which they have. But here it sounds like they were anticipating it ahead of time.
Absolutely. Yes, that's exactly right.
I want to go back to the cost, $125,000. And so the first thing I did is I go, wonder what is the most expensive airline ticket you could buy? And what I found was that for $30,000 on, I think it's an airline from the Middle East, you can have your own like mini apartment with a shower. I suppose it's on a 747 or a very large wide body aircraft, $30,000. So you're getting close, right? I mean, it's a factor of four. It's not a factor of 10 or 100 compared to the most expensive airline ticket that's out there. What do you think has to happen to get that 125 down to, you know, it's like a ticket from London to LA or something like a business class seat or, you know, get it down to 10K or 5K.
Yeah, no, I think you're raising all kinds of interesting points. So first of all, when we set the ticket price, we actually looked a lot at what's happening in the luxury travel industry, right? So people go on these beautiful safaris, you go to the Antarctic, go on a plane flight, you know, around the world. That's all in the area of $100,000 to $200,000. So we're right in there with what you might call the luxury travel industry. And so, you know, the way we think about it is, you know, how exciting it would be for people to be sort of sitting around the dining room table thinking about, well, are we going to go to on another safari? Are we going to go see the Northern Lights? Kind of done that. Or are we going to go to space? So we've in many ways sort of created a new destination for people to think about going to. So that's incredibly exciting. And the demand is so huge, Ed, that it is likely that the ticket prices are going to go up before they're going to go down. However, having said that, we are obviously, of course, thinking about what it would take over the long run to bring prices down. And, you know, I think eventually they will come down. You know, we're thinking about tiered products. I don't know that the higher end one will go away. But, you know, it's about scale. It's about getting a lot of people flying. When you're only flying a handful of people a year, as is really currently happening, it's going to be very difficult to get the prices down. But once you've got thousands of people flying to space, that's when you're going to start seeing the prices really rocket down. I mean, they've already come down a lot over the last years. If you think about just the price of rocket launches, I'm not talking necessarily space travel per se, but rocket launches. And then the same thing will happen just with efficiency of scale as we start flying more and more people to space.
Do you think there could be more Neptunes, or could it be that maybe you have a capsule that's the size of a 747? You have 100 people. And, I mean, maybe both. Have you thought much about how that'll evolve?
Yeah, I mean, look, honestly, Ed, we're very focused on getting Spaceship Neptune flying, but yeah, something like that.
Something along those lines. The other thing is that I thought of, again, these are the thoughts that came to my mind when I first heard about this. I said, wow, a big hydrogen balloon. And I'm sure people have mentioned this to you, but the first thing I thought about was, you know, the Hindenburg. I said, oh my God, whenever somebody uses hydrogen in a balloon, it's not a good thing.
Hydrogen has gotten such a bad rap because of that.
Here comes the hydrogen, the Hindenburg question, right? So I'm sure, especially if you're going to be taking the first trip up or one of the first, that you're doing everything you can about safety. So first of all, why not helium instead of hydrogen? And since you've gone with hydrogen, what do you have to do to make it safe?
So helium is completely unobtainium. It is in very, very short supply. And in fact, it is in such short supply that if we were to use it, we would literally be competing with hospitals for their MRIs. That's how bad it is.
Could you have done it with helium? Because it is a little bit heavier.
We could have done it with helium, but you're right. Hydrogen is a better lift gas. I mean, it is actually a better gas to be using. So now let's talk about the Hindenburg question, which is obviously what pops into people's minds who have heard about the Hindenburg. So Hindenburg was not a balloon, and that's actually critically important. It was not designed for hydrogen. It was designed for helium, which is also important. And actually, the hydrogen is not what caught it on fire. So I could go into all of the gory details of what happened, but remember, it was over 85 years ago. Now, let's talk about balloons. So balloons have been flying with hydrogen since the 1700s, and thousands of them have been flown around the world. It's used in sport balloons now, actually, all over the world. And thousands of them have been flown with hydrogen. There is not a single recorded incident that involves hydrogen.
So what has the technology done to make hydrogen safe?
So, you know, there's just been a lot of people working it. There's so many ways to think about this. You know, cars use petrol. I'm sorry, that shows my Brit roots. Gasoline, right? If you get air and the fumes from gas mixing, now you've got a highly volatile mixture, right? That could ignite if you get a spark. So with hydrogen, it takes a lot of work to catch it on fire. You need to have it mixed with air, and then you need an ignition source. And we don't have any of that. You just don't have that with balloons. Remember, when you're launching, you're going up through, if anything is coming out of the balloon, it's just going out into the atmosphere. It's not mixing in a container with air. It just doesn't happen. So you've got essentially, you know, the hydrogen is a pure hydrogen mix inside the balloon. So there's nothing for it to ignite with. And then when you're in space, there's nothing even outside the balloon. So it just doesn't happen. So this is, they have been flown thousands and thousands of times without an incident. And it's very safe. There's a reason we have the hydrogen economy that's emerging, right? Hydrogen is used all over the world for many, many different processes, including making some of our food. That's how ubiquitous using hydrogen is. It's just sadly, you know, what a tragedy the Hindenburg was, but that is what sticks in everybody's mind. But it is, honestly, it is pretty irrelevant at this moment in time.
And I think it's something that people have to get used to, hydrogen. Like you said, it's used in sporting balloons. I think you mentioned that. It's also being used as a potential source for powering cars as well.
Cars, trucks, ships, planes, lots of things, right? I mean, you're going to see it more and more and more.
But you are going into space. So the you're safe with the hydrogen. It's a technology that's become quite mature. It's not a lot of issues with it. But in the capsule itself, you said there's a pilot. For the most part, the pilot's going to be able to enjoy himself. Hopefully, he's not drinking too much champagne. But things can go wrong. I would imagine you have a ground control of some kind. What are they doing? There's some remote monitoring control going on. And what happens if something does go wrong?
Yeah, so there's a lot in there, right? So safety obviously is absolutely critical. So this is a really safe way of going to space. So let's kind of break that down. So the balloon is the primary flight system. That's what's carrying the capsule to space and then safely returning it to Earth. So the balloon itself is the kind of balloon that NASA has flown over 1,000 times, ESA, our team has flown it many times. It's a very well understood technology. Then between the balloon and the capsule is a set of parachutes, four parachute systems, and they're only used in an off-nominal scenario because the capsule goes up under the balloon and back down under the balloon, which also means it's a very seamless experience because you don't ever transfer from one kind of flight system to another. That also means you get rid of all of that complexity. So you're just going up and down. So it's pretty straightforward, right? But the parachutes are there just in case. So there's four of them and you don't need all of them to work. So you've even got redundancy within the parachutes. And then the capsule itself, I mean, that's the kind of thing I've been, you know, working on most of my career is working on those kinds of systems and our team. And there's lots of redundancies within the capsule as well. I mean, as we talked about, a really simple example is just the operations. It can be operated from the ground. It can be operated automatically. And then it can also be operated by the captain. So there's just redundancies built into everything.
And when you say operated, is there steering going on?
So you're right. It's not operated in the way that we think of flying an airplane. Things don't happen very quickly in a balloon. So so operated is that we've got to manage the, make sure we're watching what's happening with our environmental control inside the capsule, or when we start to descend, make sure that we start that at the right time, those kinds of things. So you're right. There really isn't that much.
And you said it's like a parabola. So you go up and you come down. How far away are you from where you started when you get back down?
Roughly 50, 75 miles. It kind of depends on the time of year.
Okay. So it's not a lot of wind when you get, like 18 miles up, I think, something like that?
Yeah, it's almost 20 miles up. That's exactly right.
You mentioned in your career, you've built these environments and suits for people. And I was reading about the Red Bull space jump that Alan Eustace did. And one of the things I found fascinating about that is you were involved in the design of that suit, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, our team was. So it was part of a former company that Tabor and I co-founded called Paragon Space Development Corporation that's now run by our third co-founder. And that actually, technically, that company is what did the StratX jump.
That you're referring to,
where we broke the Red Bull Stratos jump. Paragon built the spacesuit. It was actually the first spacesuit, believe it or not, it was the first new spacesuit built, tested, and flown in America in 40 years when we flew it. Insane.
And what year was that?
We broke the record in 2014.
And so for people that may not be familiar, 136,000 feet up, and how many miles is that?
People probably wouldn't be familiar. So everyone would remember the Felix Baumgartner jump because that was heavily promoted. And in fact, they kind of broke the internet with it at the time. Their head of content for that is now our head of content as well. So he's the one who brought you those incredible iconic images of Felix standing on the threshold, looking out dramatically over the planet. And then he just sort of throws himself out. I mean, it's sort of mad to watch. I was one of the 10 million people watching real time. And so that was done in 2012, and he went to 128,000 feet. He was actually taken up in a capsule, and he had to step out of the capsule. It turns out it's much simpler and counterintuitively safer for this particular application to take, in this instance, Alan Eustace, who was at the time a Google executive, up in a spacesuit, literally just hanging onto the balloon. So he was connected to the balloon. We took him up for just over 2 hours. It took him to get up to 136,000 feet, you're right. Then we intentionally dropped him. He free fell for almost 5 minutes. He broke the speed of sound. And then he opened his parachute and came in for a safe landing. I mean, it was incredibly exciting. And the reason that you wouldn't have heard about it is because we didn't want it. Google didn't want it. Alan didn't want any press really to speak of. So we had just a smidgen. We had a New York Times reporter at the final record jump, just, you know, because if it's not in the press at all, it didn't happen. So
what I found interesting about this and the challenges of developing a suit like this is there was some unique combinations of temperature going up and pressure going down. And I don't know if this is that much different than a space suit that you would wear for a spacewalk, say, where you go from, you know, the environment we're used to here on Earth to the weightlessness and zero, no atmosphere space. But here, sometimes temperature was going up, pressure was going down. Sometimes it was a reverse. How did that make it more challenging than, say, making a conventional, if there's such a thing as a conventional spacesuit?
Yeah, so it was the number of different kinds of environments that he had to go through. So when you're in a typical spacesuit going on EVA, you're dealing with one kind of environment, and that's the vacuum of space. In this instance, he had to go up through the troposphere, which is a thick atmosphere that gets very cold. I mean, it's minus 90 at one point when you're going up through it. So you have to deal with this very cold atmosphere. Then finally, you get up into a vacuum with the sun beating on him. And if he was up there for very long, now he's going to overheat. So you have this very interesting environment. And then he's hurtling back down to space. And the aerodynamics are super important. So if you've ever seen images of his suit, you'll see that there's an aerodynamic shell on his front that covers all of his life support systems because he was falling down at the speed of sound. And, you know, just very slight changes in the dynamics of what was happening on his front body affected his aerodynamics very significantly. So there were all these different things. Oh, and then, of course, we at one point had a spacesuit with rollerblades on it, which is the only suit you will ever see with rollerblades because for testing, the plane doorway where you jump out was too short for him to stand up. So they literally put him on his chest and pushed him out the back of the plane so that he could test the suit and all of the parachute systems. And
so it had nothing to do with landing. It wasn't like landing gear or anything like that. Just to get up. Takeoff gear.
It was just to get him out the plane. It was pretty funny.
Did you learn anything from the design of the suit? Because your balloon is going through all these different, up and...
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, we learned a huge amount about operating in that environment, right? About this kind of... It's the same kind of balloon that we're using for Spaceship Neptune. So, exactly. We have a deep understanding of operating in that environment because we did all those flights with Alan a number of times going up through this. And subsequently, I mean, we've flown a lot of balloons since then as well for science. So there's lots to learn that have been applied to what we're doing at Spaceship Neptune.
What about Biosphere 2? What did you learn from that that's impacting what you're doing on Space Perspectives?
Oh my gosh, how long do you have? Fundamentally, what we learned that is directly applicable to what we're doing is really what I talked about right at the beginning, which is that experience of being part of our biosphere. I mean, that set Tabor and me off on this course, on this life's journey to take us all to space. That is really where that desire, that passion was ignited for us, was inside Biosphere 2. So as we think about what we're doing today, with Spaceship Neptune at Space Perspective. It really is the culmination of everything we have done through our careers leading to this moment, starting all the way back at our time in Biosphere 2.
It's more of an inspiration that's lived on after that too.
Yeah. I mean, look, we're not using biospheres per se. I will say that the thing that we really learned there is sort of total systems thinking, meaning to say, you know, you have to think of things in their interconnected nature, not as individual pieces, because individual pieces, when they're interacting with other individual pieces, you know, there's sort of these emergent properties that occur. And so certainly that absolutely fed forward into what we're doing today.
For the last part of our talk today, I want to talk a little bit about the future of space travel and pick up right here with Biosphere. One thing we haven't talked about, at least with respect to Biosphere, I think it was 2 years or a long period of time. What about the mental aspects of being with the same 7-8 people for all that time? I mean, it could be good, could be bad, but too bad, you're stuck.
Ed, you got to read my book about it. We all went completely mad. My book's called The Human Experiment for a reason.
Oh, well, does that not bode well for future space travel, you think?
So I think as humans, we are generally pretty resilient. So it does take resilience, for sure. That's one of the key attributes for people going on something like this. It was the most incredible thing to be involved with. It was the hardest thing I ever done. Right. It was, you know, 8 of us sealed inside. Talk about cabin fever. I mean, it's cabin fever, you know, just like blown out of proportion. Turns out that there is a constellation of symptoms that tend to occur with people in isolated, confined environments, as it's called. So it happens to people in the Antarctic, if they're a long time on a submarine. And there's different aspects of it. You know, one of them is you tend to break into warring factions, which is what we did. We had 8 people in there, and we broke into, it turns out that 8 is the worst number.
You needed an odd number.
Yes, you need an odd, not 3. 3 is even worse because you get 2-on-1. But other than that, you need an odd number. So otherwise you get 4-on-4 and it's really stable. And that's what happened to us.
What do you think the right number is? 9?
Well, it completely depends what it's for, right?
So, like a biosphere. Biosphere 3, let's call
it. Yeah, I mean, if it had been 7 or 9, it would have been better.
So, there you go. Got to get that deciding vote.
Yeah, because it also just makes it more dynamic. We just got in these 2 clicks that would not break down.
Yeah. Lessons learned there. So you're not signing up for Biosphere 3. I imagine, right?
Oh, sure. If that was a reason to do it, I'd
you give it. You go for it.
I am a little busy right now, though.
The next adventure.
I'm a little busy getting us all to space, but once we've done that, if there's a good reason, you betcha.
So, speaking of getting to space and biospheres, when do you think we'll have that first biosphere on Mars?
Oh, on Mars! Oh, you're jumping straight
to
Mars.
Let's do moon and then Mars.
So I think moon is super interesting. There's been so many debates over the years. Oh, are we going to do moon? Are we going to do Mars first? Look, I think moon is super interesting because it's close, because I want us all to be going, right? I don't want it just to be for the few scientists, for the few astronauts, that eventually we're going to have hotels, we're going to have people living on the moon. And that's super exciting. And that is going to happen before we have people really living long-term on Mars, simply because it's so far away and difficult to get to. And I think that's super exciting. Not because I want us to be leaving planet Earth, but because I think these explorations, these outposts, they bring us things that otherwise could not happen here on Earth, right? I mean, there's the reason why the great navigators explored our world initially, our planet that seemed so huge initially. Now our solar system seems so huge. Now imagine if we're going out and all of those people will be looking back at Earth and having that space perspective, and in increasing amount, the further you get away, right? You get that little tiny experience of the pale blue dot that Carl Sagan spoke about when he took that image of Earth from the edge of our solar system in the 90s. I mean, wow, that was an iconic image. So I think it's very exciting and will definitely happen. Can I tell you when? Probably not.
You think 10 years? Maybe? Possibly on the moon?
I don't think people will be living on the moon in 10 years.
But visiting maybe for 6 days or something.
Yeah, we'll be routinely going at 100%. Yes.
It's interesting, the pale blue dot. For those that haven't, if you look it up, I think you can find it. I think it was the Voyager turned around and it took a picture of what was behind it. And there was a little blue dot. And I would imagine someday space travelers from Earth will be coming back. Oh, there's a little blue dot. We'll be home in no time.
Yes, exactly.
And is it really that much different than the days of the explorers when they were crossing the Pacific or the Atlantic and they said, oh, God, who knows what's out there? And then suddenly they see some trees or whatever on land and they drop people. But at the time, it seems like an insurmountable challenge.
Exactly. 100% agree with that. It's in our DNA, right? I mean, I think some of us just are driven to explore.
What do you think is the biggest difference between an environment on the moon or on Mars, let's just say, wherever, outside of Earth, the difference between an environment that holds you just for a short visit, say for 6 days, versus one where people could live there permanently, born, live out your life in this new place? What's the biggest difference between those two environments?
So I think about that a lot because it's the difference between camping and going home. When you go camping, you're very happy to sleep on the ground. Well, a lot of people are very happy to sleep
except
on the ground
glampers,
in
the
a
people
tent.
That glamp, right?
Okay, fair point. So you know, there's different levels of, but even with glamping, I don't know that you're going to necessarily want to live like that all the time. That's the difference, is that when you see bases that are currently designed for people to live on the moon or Mars, it really feels like something that you could go for a while, but I don't know about you, but it doesn't feel like it's somewhere where I would feel like is home. We need to be building for the long term. We need to be building places that feel like home. And that doesn't just mean, oh, I'm going to have a more comfortable chair to sit on when I'm on the moon or Mars. It's like, oh, we need to take our biosphere with us. You'll see we have like a little smidgen nod to that in Spaceship Neptune. We have some plants inside Spaceship Neptune because it is a nod to the fact that we don't thrive without other life with us. And so going to somewhere like the moon or eventually Mars, we have to take that with us. We have to take our biosphere with us in many ways and put the human experience at the center of it. It's sort of the same way, right? When you think about space travel as the way we've mostly thought about it, it's the right stuff. It's like, I'm going to put up with the discomfort. It's hero stuff. Well, there's only so many of us that are born to be heroes. Let's just face it. If we're going to go live there, it has to be something. We have to change the paradigm of that so that it really does feel like home and somewhere we can not just survive, but thrive.
And thriving is a great, great word to use to describe this because we naturally think about all the systems you had, like in the biosphere, right? We have to water, air, food, and all that. But, you know, it is also another opportunity. I'm going to leave this as our last serious question, at least, is now suddenly, and I would imagine if you had a place like this on the moon or Mars, you're going to have people from all the places on Earth, right? It probably gives you a new opportunity to figure out, well, what are our rules or how are we going to live together? What are the laws we're going to have? Because now we got a chance to do it all over again based on thousands and thousands of years. Almost an impossible question to answer, and it wasn't on the list that I gave you, but do you have any thoughts on how would you do it different?
Yeah, so it's a really, really difficult question to answer, right? So if we look to the International Space Station as a model, I mean, that's been pretty, pretty awesome over the years, right? The people have come to the station from all over the world. People have been up there whilst there's even been unrest between the countries that are up there, so represented by the people that are up there, and yet they overcome it. They still are together as human beings. I mean, that's it, right? They're up there as human beings. They are representing their countries, but they're up there as individuals, and they make serious bonds with the people they're up there with. And the same is going to happen on the moon. People will make serious bonds, but to be fair, we don't have a regulatory environment. We don't have laws, really, that cover what's going to happen there. And that's an area where we're way behind.
Well, an adventure in more than one way, I guess, it gives us something to look forward. Jane, thank you. Thank you so much for a really, really interesting discussion and opening up our eyes on Future Car Podcast to the future of mobility in a new dimension. Thank you so much.
You bet. That was super fun. Thanks, Ed.